This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Suan. There's no denying that more needs to be done to address mental health and healthcare in Malaysia, but are our policies and politicians doing and talking enough about it? So with GE15 looming on this episode of Mind Matters, we want to take a look at whether mental health matters in GE15 manifestos and looking beyond that, what the next government must do to improve the landscape of mental health in Malaysia. So first up, joining me on the show today is Hasbi, a lived experience advocate, to share his perspective on mental health issues. And later on in the show, we'll be hearing from Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq bin Amir Nordin as well, consultant psychiatrist at University of Malaya Medical Centre. But first, Hasbi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Sven, for inviting me.
So I want to start by taking this bigger picture look at the healthcare system, right? How would you describe the state of mental healthcare services, particularly in the public healthcare system at the moment?
I would describe it as one thing. But having said that, the larger issue is also inequitable distribution of resources. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at distribution of services and services provided as well. And a lot of it is very minimal. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of barriers to access. And one of the things that we don't really talk about is how discrimination and stigma are also barriers of access. One of the things that we're not really doing anything about. This is beyond physical facilities and manpower and training. There are a lot of other things that stand in the way. So how I would describe, again, I go to the word one thing. It's very one thing, and I wish that we could improve a lot of it.
Mm. The fact that you say that it's one thing means that there are a lot of areas that are lacking in this system, right? And of course, a lot of us are very familiar with the lack of healthcare professionals, of mental healthcare professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, counsellors. That is very clear. But And then you talked about the stigma, the barriers that patients face, right? Tell me a bit more about that. You know, how does this current state affect how patients can access mental health care services?
Okay, I'm gonna relate some stories from lived experience, mm-hmm. From myself and also from other clients as well. I'll start it off by saying this: are mental health care services accessible for the disabled? Is psychotherapy available for the deaf, for instance? Is psychotherapy available and accessible for someone with intellectual disability? Mm. I'm not even talking about non-disabled who can easily, relatively easily walk into klinik kesehatan, get a referral, maybe get an assessment at that point, and then maybe get referred to specialist services. How much more difficult would it be for someone with a disability beyond a mental disorder, mm-hmm. right? Let's say someone who is a wheelchair user. How accessible are public healthcare facilities? Someone with an intellectual disability. Is mental healthcare information available out there in easy to understand formats? We're not even looking at that. I want to take that conversation a bit further than just talking about basic access. Mm-hmm. Basic access is still very, very lacking. And what we have is not disability. I use the term disability informed. So a couple of weeks ago, I brought a friend who is in crisis, obviously very, very distressed, suffering from personal loss and a lack of support. And this person is disabled, physically disabled. I would have said that this person needed to be admitted immediately. He asked for help. He reached out to me. We decided, okay, I'll help him access mental health care services. I'll sit in with him during his assessment. And one of the things that the triage doctor said, the earliest appointment we can give you is 2 months from now, which was in January. And that's actually quite fast. We're looking at maybe 3 to 6 months. Most times, to get to finally see a mental health care professional. And 2 months is very fast. And the further advice given was, if you cannot deal with the ideation, mm-hmm. please come back to the emergency room and we will assist you. Now, that's totally fine for a non-disabled person to do. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm saying relatively fine, right? Relatively fine. But a person with a disability, especially a physical disability, that would be so much harder. So this is what I mean when I say that our mental health care services are not disability informed, because they're only dealing with one form of disability, which is mental disorder. But what about others who are disabled, others on the disability spectrum? So if we are not even looking at this, the weakest and the most marginalized, then we can't really be proud of our universal healthcare system. There is no real coverage, I would say. The coverage is on paper. Mm-hmm. It looks nice, but not really the reality on the ground.
Mm. And when healthcare appointments are so far and few in between, right, how does it impact people who are struggling with their mental health in the meantime? Because you're sort of in a corner, right? You have very few options.
Sure. There are options on paper, mm-hmm. right? Again, it's an issue of distribution of resources and facilities. The distance, the gap in between appointments, especially for someone who's newly diagnosed, who may themselves be struggling with accepting the diagnosis, is does tend to lead to negative health outcomes, does tend to lead to a slower pace of remission or recovery for certain conditions. And it does impact how clients view services as well. A lot of the clients leave thinking that no one cares. I'm going to contextualize it like this. The first time someone sees a mental health care professional is probably the worst day of their lives. No one goes to the hospital because they're feeling great. And a lot of times people who have been, who finally get themselves to hospital to get to see a mental health care professional, have struggled and thought about it for a very, very, very long time. They are thinking about what will my parents say, what my family say, what will my friends say, and they're also struggling with their own identity issues. Am I crazy? And these issues are compounded when they finally get to the healthcare professional. It doesn't help if the doctor themselves are judgmental. And so you go away with maybe medication and maybe another appointment, which is 3 months away. And you're left to your own devices to deal with one, that diagnosis, to adjusting to medication, and most likely a lack of support. And a lot of people fall off the wagon, default. I don't want to use the word non-compliance. It implies that there's a power imbalance. But yes, that's mm-hmm. the word that a lot of people use, defaulting and not complying. This has been the experience of many people that have spoken to me, that they don't feel like the healthcare system cares. It's very impersonal. Having said that, I do know that there are a lot of mental health care professionals who display a lot of empathy, who are very good at their jobs, but the system holds them back as well.
The need to address mental health is not something that's just sort of popped up in recent years just because we're seeing more of it, right? Mental health issues have existed for a long time. But, you know, there is acknowledgement that it is a topic that is increasingly destigmatized and more people are feeling okay to talk about it relatively. And also because of that, we're also seeing it sort of become a sexy topic, if I could put it, for a lot of politicians as well, because they recognize that it's something that needs to be addressed. But how would you describe our policy approach to tackling mental health in recent years? And I guess I'm thinking here in terms of, do we tend to focus on it as a clinical health issue, or do we tend to look at it in terms of the socioeconomic determinants that impact people's mental health?
I use the term kumbaya instead of sexy, but I get what you mean. A lot of times the narrative, the public discourse around mental health, mental ill health, if I want to be precise, is very very positive thinking, very pop psychology. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's fine as long as it doesn't contribute to misconceptions and more stigma, more discrimination, as long as it doesn't add more barriers to access. One of the issues that I find with the narrative, the mainstream discourse around mental ill health, is that we don't want to talk about the dirtier, the less shiny parts of it. We don't want to talk about involuntary admissions. We don't want to talk about forced treatments. Right? We don't want to talk about capacity for decision making. These are the issues. But these are the issues that are extremely important, because these are basic fundamental issues that revolve around autonomy and agency of the client. Now, I'm not even talking about access yet. So autonomy and agency of the client is very important, because end of the day, for someone to recover, someone to go into remission, that person must take control of their own well-being. Having said that, of course, there are other social determinants of health that also determine what care you can access, what information you can access. It's a very fluid kind of situation. I keep talking, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm very sorry about the swearing. But I think this is why it's important for us to understand the social model of disability. So mental disorders fall under the spectrum of disability. Mm-hmm. I would say that for any policies that address mental ill health and well-being in the general population, must be framed with the social model of disability in mind. The social model of disability is simplistically, our impairments are not a problem. The problem is inaccessible public spaces, negative social norms like stigma and discrimination. So you're talking about a status quo which is very, very hostile towards persons with disabilities, right? Including people with mental disorders. So one of the issues I would say, for a very long time, because we've relied on the medical model. Mm-hmm. So yes, for a very, very long time, a lot of our policies are based around the problem is the illness, let's fix the illness. We have not really talked about preventive care. And because mental disorders are invisible, a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their heads around thinking, what is preventive mechanisms for mental disorders? Mm-hmm. Preventive care is basically addressing social determinants of health. Are we framing mental ill health in the context of a living wage, accessible housing, social protections, good governance? We're not. But having said that, in recent, really, really recent time, probably within the last year or so, thanks to the effort of advocates who have been talking about this for a very long time, there have been gestures towards, oh yes, let's address social determinants of health in policy. So the caretaker health minister right now has recently mentioned some aspects of that. But I don't think it's enough. I don't think it is enough because we're not really looking at it in a systemic view. Are we looking at how discrimination affects mental health? Are we looking at how structural discrimination affects mental health? The fact that people can't get a job, the people can't get accessible housing. Are we looking at this in terms of how it affects mental health? And I think we missed the chance. But it's not too late. But I think we missed the chance with COVID as a wake-up call. We should be looking at framing our policies to address health issues, including mental health, based on social determinants of health. Because the social determinants of health are the non-medical factors that affect good or bad health outcomes, and they account for between 30 to 50% of a contributing factor, depending on what study you read. And I think that's a much longer term, much more sustainable way of addressing mental ill health.
Hmm. All right. So now if I want to take a look at GE15, right? If we take a look at how mental health has been described in key political coalitions' manifestos, Pakatan Harapan's manifesto had included mention of expanding My Salam to the M40, and My Salam includes health assessment and mental health care, including counselling. Pakatan Harapan also included a line on pushing for suicide decriminalisation, as well as mental health protection by investing more attention into increasing mental health care, including through insurance schemes that cover mental health. In Perikatan Nasional's manifesto, there were two mentions, one in terms of education and in strengthening the psychological support system, including mental health, and on the health aspect to strengthen access to mental health help in public facilities. And then looking at Barisan Nasional's, there was only one mention that I could find, which is to construct more specialist hospitals, including for mental health. What do you make of these promises, right? Did they stand out to you? Are they significant enough?
Okay. I'll say this. No matter who is in power, all these things are good things. All these things must be done, no matter who is in the administration. I'm not going to stump for any coalition on the show. But it seems that Pakatan has a better idea And I think they have involved some, I guess, lived experience advocates in coming up with these policies. Looking at what Barisan Nasional has put in, they're still looking very much at it from a physical illness kind of approach.
Building more hospitals.
Which is great. I'm not saying no, don't do it. Right? But I think it's very limited in that sense. Perikatan is good. They're talking about in education, strengthening the psychological support system. All these things must be done. And even whoever wins, all these things must be done because we are falling far behind. One of the things I would like to see in terms of how they roll out these promises, I guess, is articulate the social determinants of health and the social model of disability. Frame your policies along that. The idea is, I'm fond of saying this, if it works for OKU, it works for everyone. So if you can build, construct systems, processes and facilities that enfranchise the weakest and most vulnerable in society, then you don't have to worry about everyone else because you're already protecting the weakest. If it works for the weakest, it works for everyone.
If you had to pick three, Hasbi, you know, what would you like to see from the next government in terms of concrete and specific policies or reforms in addressing mental health?
Okay. Since you frame it that way, I'm gonna lari a little bit. One of the first things that we must do is conduct an audit. Audit on accessibility. We don't have a baseline. If I can bring in a more macro view, mm-hmm. right? We ratified the CRPD, the Conventions on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, in 2010.
12 years ago.
Yes, 12 years ago. With two outright objections, reservations, and three interpretative declarations. Interpretative declarations basically means that we looked at the CRPD and we looked at domestic legislation and said, our domestic legislation is the same. It's good enough, right? I would say no. Definitely not. One of the obligations that we had with the CRPD was that we were to submit an initial preliminary report after ratifying. This would provide the baseline for accessibility. We've not done that at all. This report should guide us in terms of what policies we should bring in. Because then we have a baseline. Where are we lacking? Right now, there are a lot of people who are saying very, very valid things. But because we don't really have a big macro view, mm-hmm. right? Information is very hard to access. Even as an advocate, it's very difficult for me to say with absolute certainty that this must be done, that must be done. But one of the first things, post that audit, and this is on none of the manifestos, relooking at all legislation, with an OKU element, with a mental health element, and removing all outdated information. If I give an example, like the Penal Code. The Penal Code has the word idiot. At some point in history, in medical history, idiot was a legitimate term. There was idiot, moron, and imbecile. These were terms to describe various levels of intellectual disability. But through popular usage, they became stigmatized, mm-hmm. and the medical fraternity removed it from its lexicon. That's fine. But we still have it in legislation. And it still carries the weight of that stigma. Right? I would like to see all laws that are related to mental health that contain outdated medical terms to be updated to current medical understanding. Second thing would be non-discrimination legislation. I would like to see any coalition with the guts actually to do it. Non-discrimination legislation, in my opinion, would help address a lot of the soft power discrimination that we see in our society. Whether it's someone with a disability who gets rejected from a job offer, it contributes to already long-term exclusion from society, and then it contributes to mental ill health, or the fact that someone cannot get housing, or the fact that someone cannot get into university because of their disability. This is discrimination and it should be addressed. I don't want to force legislation to do it. It has to come from society as well. But sometimes we also need to regulate behavior. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think non-discrimination legislation will be good. I give one example, the Equality Act in the UK. All government services refer to the Equality Act to ensure that services are rendered regardless of gender, age, disability and any other construct. Services must be rendered to everyone, full stop. And government is bound to make sure that this happens. So that's number two, non-discrimination legislation.
And number three?
Number three is, so this is directly involved in mental health care lah, and the healthcare system. I want to see formalized mechanisms to involve lived experienced experts in the healthcare system and in the clinical setting as well. Currently, there are some mechanisms. I'm personally involved in one of them. I'm on the Bipolar Disorder Clinical Practices Guideline Review Committee. So I'm contributing to that as a patient advocate. But I would like to see it expanded to involve more people, because there are a lot of people out there with lived experience who can and want to contribute. One of the things I try to emphasize is this. I am not diminishing the experience of healthcare professionals in their fields. But healthcare professionals in general work in silos. Specialists work in silos. So they don't really see the interplay between that those intersections of oppression and discrimination that clients go through. Clients see this, right? Clients that go to JKM, clients that go to public healthcare, clients that then go back to their B40 households living on minimum wage. These are all negative multipliers. And we need to hear the voices from this group of people. And this is very niche. So if we can, the third thing, going back to that, is basically formalizing mechanisms that bring these perspectives into healthcare and into larger systems of governance. Mm.
Do you think that it will make a difference to have an MP with that lived experience, for example? Or is it about sort of what you mentioned, right? That governance system, bringing people with lived experience into a formalized mechanism so that at least policymakers are listening to them directly?
How do we know we don't already have MPs with lived experience? Mm-hmm. Because of discrimination, a lot of them cannot come out and say it. And also, there are legal repercussions. We have provisions in the federal constitution that prohibit persons of unsound mind from standing for office or being appointed senator, among other things. Unsound mind is not a medical diagnosis.
It's a very broad and vague term as well.
Yeah, very broad and vague term, and could be used to, could be weaponized against people like me if I decided to contest for MP one day. Mm-hmm. But who knows? We might already have MPs there. Now, going back to your question, whether these MPs are allowed to use their lived experience to inform policies, that's debatable. Because how our system of representation works is very rigid in a lot of ways. So it's always party line first. You may have MPs that want to speak more about this issue, but can't. Back to your question, I would argue, yes, it would help. If we had MPs who could speak about it, one, it would make them more relatable, because mm-hmm. there's a great power distance between us and our policymakers and lawmakers, right? Mm-hmm. So having an MP who is open and honest about their condition would, I think, one, make them a lot more relatable and actually help with actual representation and diversity of opinions in policymakers, right? At the same time, I think that there is some value in, let's say, MPs who don't have lived experience, who bring in persons with lived experience. I personally have been asked by a few MPs to provide some input, and I've always been happy to do that. But it doesn't always translate. Right? I can tell them 10 things, and maybe one thing will come out.
That's always the challenge, isn't it, for something to translate from discussion into a policy?
Yes, that's right. And having said that, I am very well aware that this is because of that rigid structure that a lot of political parties operate in. Mm.
And I guess to wrap up our discussion today, Hasbi, you know, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier when we were talking about social determinants of health, right? It's not purely just a clinical issue we're talking about.
Sure.
Do you think then mental health should be purely under the purview of MOH, which it pretty much is now?
I would say no. But I qualify it with this. Clinical services need clinical ethical protections. So in that sense, yes, clinical services should remain under the purview of MOH. And any outsourcing of services should have the same stringent ethical protections. This is for client safety, mm-hmm. right? But I would also like to see the social determinants of health articulated in other ministries. But I would think MOH would have to take the lead on that. So let's say, for instance, is our climate change policy informed by KKM's opinion? Is a living wage or our discussion on minimum versus living wage informed by how living wage actually helps with depression? There are many, many studies already that says that. Does KKM have best practices recommendations for other ministries? So do they have input in? I would like to see that, KKM putting in the health aspect in there. Again, with the idea that we want to protect and enfranchise the weakest and most vulnerable in society. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Hasbi.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me, Suan.
I've been speaking to Hasbi, a lived experience advocate, about GE15 manifestos and mental health, as well as the reforms that he'd like to see addressing mental health issues post-GE15 as well. After the break, I'll be speaking to consultant psychiatrist Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq bin Amir Noordin, so stay tuned to Mind Matters on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. It is time for our monthly Mind Matters series, and today we're taking a look at whether mental health matters in GE15 manifestos and beyond, and what the next government must do to improve the landscape of mental health in Malaysia. So before the break, I was joined by Hasbi, a lived experience advocate, on what his experience has been like with the healthcare system and the reforms that he'd like to see post-GE. And now I'm joined by our regular guest, Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq bin Amir Noordin, consultant psychiatrist at University Malaya Medical Centre, for his take as a healthcare provider himself. Glad to have you back on, Dr. Amir, after a short break.
Thank you very much, Suan. It's really good to be here.
Let's talk about the current state of the healthcare system, right? Earlier, when I asked Hasbi to describe the state of our mental health care services, he described it as wanting, and that's from his perspective as a user. As a healthcare provider yourself, how do you view the state of our healthcare systems when it comes to providing mental health care services to all who need it?
So first of all, thank you very much again for having me here, and also for Hasbi for the sharing that he actually did. It's really interesting, as you rightly mentioned. Coming from the user point of view, I'll be sharing a little bit from three areas. One is from the provider, second is probably from a small policymaker, and thirdly, as an NGO advocate as well. And I think this really is important when we're looking to the aspect of mental health care at the moment. So if you're looking at from a provider point of view, there has always been in each budget some improvements in terms of either support or in terms of infrastructure or even in terms of the treatments that are provided to our Malaysian public. So I think over the years, we've seen definitely an improvement in the level of service that's provided by our Ministry of Health and all of those related to health in our country. So as a provider, I've got not much complaints in terms of providing care. Mm-hmm. However, definitely when you're looking at from a policy point of view, as we know, there's the white paper reform that we really need to get through, because the pandemic has actually shown how much of our healthcare provision has actually been tested when things are really pushed to the max. You know, that's when you suddenly realize that, yes, you do have infrastructure, but they're a bit dated. Yes, you do have people, but they might not be enough or skilled in certain areas. So I think this is where the white paper reform, as we have discussed in health, needs to be done. And surprisingly, I just came back from Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And as a result of the pandemic, they too are in the process of doing a major health reform. In fact, as their Minister of Health, Bapak Budi Gunadi, had mentioned, Bapak Joko had actually talked to him and said, like, you know, they want to have a health reform that is almost like the mother of all health reforms, right? And I think this is something that we've already initiated a little bit earlier, and we really need to get that across. So I think that's where some of our limitations are actually shown. And I think the third one is the NGOs, you know, and I think this is where we have not included people like Hasbi, people that are on the ground very much in our policy making. You know, it's only very, very recently that some of our policy discussions include NGOs on the same table. Mm-hmm. And it's not a tokenism in a sense. They're actually there to provide some level of opinions that we can then decide together whether, you know, it seems to be working or not. But it's still in the very early stages. And I think this is where we need to work together between all respective parties, NGOs, the government agencies particularly, and also the private sector in improving health. So I think this is the state that we are. Now, the other thing that I wanted to share with individuals is that over the last at least 5 to 6 years, I've noticed that there's been an increased level of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, thankfully, people are coming forward now for health care. But as we have seen, and I'm pretty sure people like Hasbi has noticed as well, the provision of service might not be in keeping with the number of people coming for service. So there's that bit of a mismatch. And the problem, of course, will be delays in time to see some kind of mental health provider, or the services that are provided to them not be up to their standards. And I think this is something that all healthcare providers really need to look out for, particularly as we, a country, start to be more developed. So definitely the level of service that we want to provide for our people should be at the standard of those developed countries as opposed to a developing nation. So I think this is where I look at the issues at the moment. And of course, the final one is that we have to remember that mental health is part of health. Because it's part of health, it transcends across every aspect of health. Now, if you look at it from a point of view of the provision of service and the agencies that involve, mental health is just not the purview of the Ministry of Health. It is everybody's business, literally, to be in mental health. And I think this is where, when we look at the topic today, Sue Ann, is when we really start to pick and you know, nitty-pick and see the areas of people's promises to us for mental health and where probably some gaps are still present.
Hmm. I think the obvious aspects of where perhaps, I guess, we're more lacking when it comes to providing mental health is when we look at it from the clinical aspect, right? We've heard so often we don't have enough psychiatrists, clinical psychologists or counsellors. And then, of course, you know, it's very common for us to hear about long waiting times for an appointment or in between appointments. But that's what we can see. We don't see the other barriers that are less obvious to us, you know, to those of us who don't need to seek help. What have been the main barriers that you still see or hear from patients when it comes to their ability to access mental health care services, especially in the public healthcare system?
Well, I think the first thing that is still a problem at the moment, even in the Klang Valley, surprisingly, you know, with all the discussions that we've been having over the last year, if not a few years now, on mental health, is that still the rakyat, there's still a, you know, a significant amount of stigma, which many NGOs have brought up. There's still a lack of full understanding about the aspect that mental health is a component of health. There's still the lack of urgency in order to assist people that require some level of support. And I think more importantly, there's still that lack of empathy for those who might be struggling, particularly with suicidal ideas, for example, or psychotic experiences in mental health care. So I think this is where the first gap is. The awareness yet is still to the level that I would expect it to be. The second, of course, as you rightly mentioned, is going to be access to health. Yeah, there's been a lot of discussions about, yes, we do have, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, and also counsellors, yet the access to them might be difficult because they might be in places where it's hard to reach.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, there might not be enough of them in the public health system, and therefore people are needing to go to the private health system. The prices in the private health system might be slightly prohibitive for many people to access. And therefore, NGOs have started to take up that slack in terms of providing that service. But again, NGOs, people must remember, people who are passionate about a certain issue and volunteer their time and expertise. And therefore, definitely, the service that they provide cannot be to the level that one would expect from, you know, a government agency or a private agency that is sort of like responsible for this. So I think this is the main two areas that I see that we are still lacking. And of course, like I said, the third one is the fact that it should be the whole of society working together for mental health, because, you know, if we believe that it's a part of health, it transcends across all relevant agencies, and we're not seeing that collaborative work that one would expect if one really believes in the cause.
So if we now turn to GE15, you know, we've seen the main political parties' manifestos, especially from Pakatan Harapan, Perikatan Nasional and Barisan Nasional, right? Not that many points on mental health specifically, but what have you made of them, Dr. Amir? You know, are they enough?
Well, I think first of all, just for the for full disclosure, I've only read the three main parties' manifestos, and I'm pretty sure that there are smaller individuals, independents that might run for you know, the electorate. But I think, to be fair, it's probably going to be these three big groups that are going to be able to pull their weight in terms of making something happen. So having looked at the three manifestos, 105 pages is one of them, 58 pages another, 48 the last one, definitely there are some commonalities. I think the first thing is all of them are in keeping with the fact that we need to increase our health budget to at least 5%. You know, presently, I think it's about 2%. YB Khairi Jamaluddin, during the health reform, had requested in his government 4% at least, a double of the 2%. But generally, in the manifestos, all of them were in agreement that it should be at least 5%. I think that's the first thing. And I think that's a very positive sign in terms of where we would like health to be. Now, the second one that I saw that has some commonalities is the eradication of poverty. Now, there's a lot of activities that were promised by all these big parties or these big groups regarding improving poverty in various forms. And I think, as we know, a social determinant of health, that poverty is the main risk factor for mental illness. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, the main one, of course, is if you're living in poverty, your environment is not going to be very conducive. You're going to be at risk of increased trauma, particularly emotional trauma. You're going to have access to good health, good food, sorry, and therefore this is going to compromise your health and nutritional needs. Issues like stunting, for example, poor nutrition, definitely will affect your physical health, which will eventually affect your mental health. And of course, poverty leads to stigma, you know, and this is where, again, stigma at young increases the risk of emotional trauma, which again is a major risk factor for mental illness in the future. So all of these components, at least in their manifesto, had brought up the fact that they are working together in reducing the number of individuals who are living in poverty to hopefully a better standard. So I think this is where I can see the commonalities. Now, again, when I share with you, the pages is where the details are at. And I think there are one, you know, at least two groups that are a little bit more thoughtful in their approach on where they would like mental health care to be. And they stated it explicitly, mental health, right? The rest, I had to go through each and every initiative and think about whether this is related to health and whether this is related to mental health. And I think there are some within all the manifestos, but the giant amount of work is actually done by Harapan's manifesto, where they explicitly, at least there's about four items there that they brought up mental health very specifically. But again, there are other aspects of their manifesto that were related to health.
So I guess on that point, right, Dr. Amir, it seems that a lot of these are still, a lot of these different aspects, when we talk about social determinants of health, people, policymakers would still be working in silos when it comes to addressing these different issues. Do you think there's space to consolidate all of this so that we holistically look at social determinants of health and how it links to physical and mental health?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Suan, because that's why I said that one of the manifestos explicitly brought up this issue that we want to share today. But the rest had it as well. It's just that you had to go look at every single small detail to appreciate that maybe this is a health issue that they're trying to relate. And as a psychiatrist, I'm you know, I'm sensitive to areas that might be related to mental health. So I thought, maybe this could be a mental health aspect. But like you rightly mentioned, it doesn't appear that they were thought of as a whole. it looks like individuals have put in ideas and they were taking up in different segments, education, health, you know, general social issues, women issues, marginalized issues. I mean, they put in all those components as opposed to putting it in one big component where they would say something like, the drivers for this would be the various agencies and here, here, here. So mm-hmm. then we know that it's been thought of as a whole rather than as individuals working, as you rightly mentioned, in silos, trying to deliver a project or program that eventually will affect the mental health needs of our population.
What are the problems that you see when all of these programs are done in silos? Because we are sort of seeing this now, right? There are good initiatives and programs and campaigns being done to address people's overall well-being and how that eventually impacts their mental health. But what have you seen if we don't cohesively look at all of this as affecting someone's mental health?
Well, I think the major issue is going to be like in any organization when you are allocated a certain amount of budget and a certain amount of responsibility, there's going to be a bit of territorial issues mm-hmm. working around. And this is where I think there's going to be an increase of waste in terms of not only manpower, but also effort. Because they're not going to be working together on a certain project, but they're working in silos. And this is where we have situations where you'll have an initiative by one ministry that almost replicates another ministry, or during the times of a disaster, where sometimes two different ministries would provide the same level of support because they were not communicating with each other. And I think this is the dangers in any organization. Or any program where you have individuals working without consulting the other.
Mm-hmm.
We would like that moving forward, that all agencies discuss with each other, particularly in this aspect, because, you know, mental health affects all, because health is something that all of us want and have. And we definitely do not want to be compartmentalizing the aspects of health to the point that the limited amount of resources that we have for it is not spent in the best way that we would like it to be.
Hmm. And to round up our discussion today, Dr. Amir, if I could maybe ask you to put on all three of your hats, right, as a psychiatrist, a policymaker, and an NGO advocate, if I could ask you to list a top three, what reforms would you like to see from the next government when it comes to improving mental health care services in the country?
Okay, so when you look at the manifestos in general, like I said, there's going to be some differences. And, mm-hmm. I think one of the differences is going to be who the target populations are, right? So there are at least two manifestos that were specifically looking at the elderly. And I think that's a very progressive way of looking at it because we are moving towards an aging society. One of the manifestos specifically brought up OKU individuals or people or groups as a target audience that they would like to focus on. And the other two were a little bit coy on that regards. Now, the other one that was brought in, I think this is very important, is the financial support. Now, we know one is access, second is ability to pay. Now, one of the gaps that has been there for at least three ministers for health that I have been, you know, part of before, whereby they can't seem to get our insurance companies as a whole to provide support and funding or at least the ability to pay their own premiums from our patients. For mm-hmm. some reason, these patients are excluded from it. In fact, some are even penalized. And of course, the third one is going to be a population that I care for that was not mentioned in any of these manifestos, which is the people living with drug addiction. You know, and I think this is something that with the new science and technology that we have now, which is very progressive, certain illnesses can actually be assisted at minimal cost. We know, for example, tobacco smoking, which was sadly not mentioned at all, is a major risk factor, not only for physical illnesses, but for mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there should be support for the generation endgame, because literally that would be the most preventive of preventive activities that one can do. So if there's going to be three things that I would look out for, I like to look out for, I think number one is going to be some changes in terms of the present policy for criminalizing suicide. really looking at the policies of not only the Penal Code, but also maybe the Mental Health Act itself.
Mm-hmm.
And globally, mental health is a priority. In fact, some countries have a minister of mental health or an advisor for mental health for the government, which means that they've put a lot of priority there. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, of course, to me, would be really to look at that insurance issue. This is, to me, a huge issue because we know from the discussion of the healthcare white paper that present, business as usual for health is just too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, we might need the support of these insurance companies. And there are a huge segment of people that have a diagnosis of mental illness that can fund themselves. And I think they need to be allowed to do so because they want to do so.
Mm-hmm.
They can pay whatever is requested of them because they are functioning fully well. It's just that they happen to have had a mental illness in the past. So I think that's the second thing that we need to look at. And I think the third one, which I think is important, is looking at targeted populations, though children, aging, and those with, like I said, drug addiction. Why these three? Because we are moving towards an aging population. The children are our future. And for those with an addiction issue, like I said, with the present science that's out there, many of them will be able to be assisted if we're able to just help them just that little bit more from the health point of view, not from the criminal or penalizing point of view. It's more of the health point of view. I think would make a huge difference for the mental health of all of Malaysians.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Amir.
Thank you very much, Suan.
I've been speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq bin Amir Nordin, Consultant Psychiatrist at University Malaya Medical Centre, for our monthly Mind Matters series. This has been Health and Living with me, Lim Suan, on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.